You're listening to the Courageous Life Podcast, helping you develop courage and resilience in a perilous and unpredictable world. This is your host, Sean Mitzel. I'm coming to you from the mountains of northern Idaho. I'm glad you're with us. On today's podcast for the Worldview segment, I talk about President Obama's recent proposal to give everyone free community college, which of course is not free at all. And for the main topic, I discuss some basics of permaculture and not so much the design science behind it or the principles of design itself, but just kind of an overarching working knowledge of permaculture and some of the principles involved in it. Okay, so it's more of on the theoretical level, if you will. On today's Worldview segment, I want to talk about a recent, bold, and glorious proposal that President Obama made. He wants to give everybody free community college for everyone. Free. Free. Who could argue with that? Who doesn't want some free stuff? Okay, so before we break this down, I want to talk about something called subsidiarity. Now, I've talked about this recently. Maybe a couple times in the last several months, but what that is, well, let me give you an example of it. It's a better way to explain it, is that the federal government should not do anything that the state governments can do for themselves. The state governments should not do anything that the county governments can do for themselves. And I'm just going to call it the local government should not do anything for which a family can do for itself. Okay, this is the idea or the principle of subsidiarity. What we have in this proposal of free community college for everyone by President Obama is an obliteration of that principle. It's a non-recognition of that principle. It is a serious overreach. And although many people might on the surface look at this and go, hey, that's great. That's great because look at, we have these tuition costs that are skyrocketing. Never mind the fact that the reason that they're skyrocketing is because direct government intervention, direct government subsidies. So what this would do, since his proposal, is that 75% of the cost would be borne by the federal government and 25% by the states, would repeat this cycle, would continue this vicious cycle, and the whole reason why we have education costs skyrocketing way above the government rate of inflation. Okay, so let's break this down. This is a quote from President Obama. Put simply, what I'd like to do is see the first 2 years of community college free for everybody who's willing to work for it. That's right, free for everybody who is willing to work for it. All right, so let's break down that logical defilade that he just spewed out. First of all, if you have to work for it, is it free? No, it's not. But I know what he means. Let me be fair. He means that the cost of tuition for that particular student would not have to be paid for by that student. But is it free? Or does it simply just mean that someone else will be paying for it? That's exactly what it means. It's not free. It's going to be paid for by someone else. In this case, since it's coming from federal money and state money, it's taxpayers. Okay, so there's several problems with this. Number one, the fact that the federal government is reaching all the way down into your living rooms and getting outside of its constitutional authority is a major problem. Okay, that is a huge problem for me. Secondly, there already are programs for those that can't afford to go to, say, community college. They're called Pell Grants. And Pell Grants have like quadrupled in use since 2009. You know, there are ways for people to go to community college extremely cheap already. There's already too much government intervention. And he wants to make this free for everyone. There's also the problem that right now, kids coming out of high school, okay, your average kid coming out of high school, I think it's something like 40 or 50% of those kids coming out of high school have to take remedial classes before they can even take college credit worthy courses, whether it's community college or a 4-year university. Okay, we're already having major educational problems, and what we're saying here, I think what we're really saying here is that we want to turn this into 6 years of high school. That's what we're doing. 6 years of high school. Okay, we're just doing a little bit of a quote-unquote specialization, even though it's not a specialization for the 2 years of community college. It's more liberal arts stuff. Okay, so there's major problems. There's no talk of how this will be funded, no talk of how this would even be a good thing. There was no talk of the disparity. And in fact, I saw one supporter of this, which is amazing to me, but there are lots of them. There are lots of people that support this, think this is a great deal. Their objection to this, their major objection to this, can get this, was that the less fortunate are already getting Pell Grants. And what that means is that the fortunate would be getting free college. And apparently they don't want the fortunate to get free college. That would somehow be unfair. Okay, do you follow that logic? It makes no sense. Okay, so this is what we have on the proposal as of last couple days. It's ludicrous. It really is. This is why it's so important, and I'm going to put a plug in for it right now, to support the Convention of States. Okay, the balance of power between the federal government and the state governments is massively out of whack. If a state decided it wanted to pursue free community college for its state citizens, it can do so. In fact, some states have done this in various ways. Okay, that's fine. Okay, I don't agree with that. I don't think a state should be paying for free community college, basically taking money from its citizens and then creating its own winners and losers. And that's what the federal government does on a large scale, as opposed to a state doing it on the state scale. Well, guess what? If states, to various degrees, and again, I support a state's right, if they want to do this, go ahead. I don't agree with it, but if they want to do it, go ahead. Because I have the freedom to choose between 50 states, okay? So if 10 of those states are ultra-liberal, ultra-progressive, super high taxes, I can choose to go live somewhere where the taxes are lower and there's less, quote-unquote, services and entitlements, because that's what I believe freedom is, okay? It's the ability to make your own way towards self-sufficiency and community and family. These are the areas where most of the work, most of the help should be occurring, not even with the state governments. But I support a state government's right to do that. Should the federal government be deep inside of someone's living room telling you that, hey, your kids are going to go to school for free, I'm just going to tax everyone to death? Of course not. Our spending is out of control. Our regulations are out of control. And we have the President of the United States going deep inside someone's living room to offer them free community college. That is ridiculous. This is why you must support the Convention of the States. For today's main topic, I want to discuss permaculture. Now, what we'll talk about today is just some broad ideas about permaculture, not specifics like how to design a food forest or how to integrate certain elements of a property to stack functions, because, you know, that is permaculture. But what we're going to talk about today is really some broad-based ideas around permaculture, and to include what permaculture is not. Okay, now, if you simply think of permaculture as design science, that's a great start. It really is. It is ecological design. It's ecological engineering. It's environmental design. It's integrated water resource management. It's sustainable architecture. It's all of those things. It's working smart and not harder. It's about creating order and controlling chaos. And we'll talk about some of those things. It's about natural farming. So it's all of these things But if we just simply think of it as design science, and you're taking all the elements that you can imagine, mostly around agriculture, but also we're talking about structures, we're talking about water and waste and energy, all of these things. So instead of stovepiping any single one of those, which we have a tendency to do, it's integrating all of those and how and trying to see how they work together best. Okay, and that's that would be a kind of a summary of permaculture. Now, I want to discuss real quick what permaculture is not, because I have a tendency to think that when most people hear the term permaculture, one of two things. Number one, they may have never heard of it. Okay, maybe they've never heard of it, or they've heard the term, they don't have any idea what it is. And number two, when they hear permaculture, what they think is a bunch of naked people rolling around in the mud, worshiping the earth. Okay, that's not permaculture. Now, are there a lot of those people in permaculture or that use permaculture? Yes. There are earth worshipers in permaculture, just like there's earth worshipers in the organic movement, just like there's earth worshipers in the natural farming realm, etc. Okay, so there is some of that, and you'll find people, and they'll be touting permaculture as the savior of the earth, and you know this is what we must do, and they will tell you that you have to be a vegan and you have to do this and you must not. They're taking permaculture to their extreme, to their agenda. Now, is permaculture because it's sustainable and because it's tends on the natural side? Do they take that and do they like it because it kind of matches up with their agenda? Well, sure, of course. But that's not permaculture. Permaculture is ecological or systems design that allows elements to work together well. And so what we're going to talk about is some basic fundamentals and principles. But first, an example. So I want to kind of delve into this and give you an example of permaculture thinking as opposed to conventional thinking. So we're going to use the chicken, and we're going to use the chicken as a design component, because that's what you should do. You need to look at everything that you have, everything that you're trying to do, and what you have, and think of them as design elements, and then think of those relationships on how they fit together. Okay, and it would be helpful to ask some questions like, what are the needs of this component, the chicken? And can they be supplied by other components? Okay, so think about that for a minute. You have chickens. What do they need? What can they be supplied by here on the homestead, for example? Where is this component incompatible with other components? Okay, so you're starting to think about placement. Where can I put the chickens? Where can I not put the chickens? Where does this component benefit other parts of the system? Okay, so not only can I use other elements of the system, might be a designed area for forage or a part of your woodlot. Can I then do placement on the chickens to be able to help those things? Or do I need to place the chickens closer to something like the garden because I like to use them to clean up the garden or to prep the garden? Twice a year or near the orchards. I mean, there's all these different functions that we can think of. And once we have those answers thought through, then we can come up with these placement ideas. And then what we have to do is take a look at our other components, our other design components, and other common elements of the homestead, like the structures, maybe it's the house, barn, maybe you have a greenhouse or you have a chicken coop. We have other elements. Maybe you have some ponds, you have some existing fencing, trellises, hedgerows. What other domestic animals do you have? Do you have Do you have anything else besides the chickens? Do you have goats or pigs, etc.? You know, what other land use elements are you using or trying to use? Do you have orchards, pastures, crops, gardens, woodlots? You know, all these design elements to think through. So if we do that, if we look at each one of those and we want the chicken to work for us, okay? We're looking at them as partners, not just, okay, we gotta feed them and water them, give them grit, give them an area for dust bath in order to get eggs. That's a singular look at a chicken, okay? It's like, here's all my inputs and I get an egg. Okay, that's not permaculture. Permaculture is looking at all of the elements and seeing how they can work together to create order. All right, so we want them to work for us. And then what we want to do is we want to list the energy and material needs of all those other elements and see if the chicken can help supply any of their needs or the other elements supplying the needs of the chicken. Okay, so that goes back and forth. And you're going to do that for each element in your design. Okay, so for example, I'm going to take the orchard. The orchard needs weeding, pest control, manure, and some pruning. It gives food, fruit, nuts, whatever, provides insects for chicken forage. Thus, the orchard and the chicken seem to need each other. Okay, they work together. I mean, it makes complete sense to run chickens through orchards, at least at planned intervals. I mean, that's just a no-brainer. Sadly, in our commercial orchards, it's against regulations in many cases to run chickens through orchards. And because of their mindset of everything has to be in its own stovepiped place and we cannot mix these elements. There are a lot of regulations in certain states and that are trying to remove all animals from these types of systems, which would be a huge mistake. It's already happening in most of your commercial spheres, but that would try and take it away from the small farmer as well, which would be terrible. All right, so we think of another one here. So we had the orchard, the example of the orchard and how the chicken fits in with the orchard. It helps keep the pests down, provides manure. It eats down the forage that's around it, so the competing grasses. How about the woodlot? Okay, so your forested area. It needs management, fire control, perhaps pest control. Some manure would be good for it. It gives you fuel, berries, seeds, insects, shelter, some warmth. So there would be beneficial interactions here as well for the chickens to be able to graze along here. And I know we're not talking about pigs right now, but this is where pigs would really come in handy. If you ran them through your woodlots at the proper interval, they could do some beneficial work for you there. How about crops? Okay, so your gardens. They require manure and seeding and harvesting and storing. It gives food for chickens and people. So scraps from the house can go to the chickens. Most scraps can go to the chickens. They have a part to play in that. They help kind of naturally till the ground, provide manure, can eat down the garden at the end of the season, can prep the garden before the season. All kinds of different things you can do with them. So those are just some minor examples of what permaculture might look like in reality. Okay, so when it on the ground, on a homestead, when you think of a chicken, don't just think of a chicken as something that provides you with eggs or something that provides you with meat. They're doing so much more. They can do so much more if you are willing to look at it that way. So it's just looking at it a different way. That's the only difference here, is that it's a comprehensive look in design science, looking at all the elements as opposed to looking at each element as its own. So here's the orchard. Here's how I manage the orchard. Here are my chickens. Here's how I manage my chickens. Here is my house. Here's how I manage my house. Instead, it's integrating all those things and how do they complement each other and work together well. All right, so the one principle that I want to start with here, well, it's not really a principle, but it's a concept, and that is of order and chaos. And I bring this up because this is really important. What we desire is order. Okay, that's what we want. That's what, if you look at most people's gardens, they got these neat little rows and they want all the weeds out and they want order. Okay, if you let that go, if you stop going to your garden and working every day, you're going to get chaos. Okay, now we can impose order on just about anything. Okay, you can impose order on any system, but there's a cost. There is a cost, and we want order, and we want order for the least input. That's a permaculture principle. Okay, so think about this example here. In the United States, the vast majority of the world, the growing of corn is done in a very commercial manner. It's done with massive machinery. It is done on the chemical treadmill. So you're talking about plowing, seeding, planting, and spraying, harvesting, and all with very huge machinery, monocrop, tens of thousands of acres. And we can create order there. You can impose order on that system, but it takes a lot. Okay, it takes all that input to impose order on that cornfield. Now, unfortunately, with the chemical treadmill that farmers have gotten themselves on in this commercial system, if they were to say, going, you know what, I'm not going to spray this year. I'm not going to, you know, spray my Roundup on my Roundup Ready corn this year. There's probably going to get chaos. Okay, they're probably going to enter a system that's not going to work for them. Okay, and it'll require a whole lot more work. Same thing for the backyard garden. If you don't go out there and weed, you're going to get chaos. Well, so what do we want to do? We want to design systems that naturally tend towards order, or at least take less input to get them in systems of order. Okay, so I use the example again of the orchard. I like to think of something more like a food forest more than an orchard, but let's just take an orchard. So even a neat road orchard that has fruits and nuts, different kinds of fruits and nuts. Okay, now we could maintain order in there. We could go through and do our pruning, and we can go through and do our spraying. We can go through and do our herbicides, our pesticides, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? Or we can do it in a natural system, and then we can run chickens through there, et cetera, to keep the pests down, to keep the weeds down, all of that. Okay? Both of those systems create order. Well, which one required less input? The system with the chickens, okay? So that's what we're going for. It's not that we don't have to put inputs in order to create order, but we have to think of ways to minimize our input, okay? Because who wants to sit and work all the time? Do you want to weed every single day all the time? I don't think so. I mean, I think that's why a lot of people are turned off from gardening. A lot of people like that. They like to go out there and keep it neat and clean and go out there and spend, you know, a couple hours every day in their garden and keep it all trimmed up. Well, to be honest with you, I would rather do less work and still be able to keep that thing very productive. And I think a permaculture system does that for you. It creates order with less input. Not no input, but less input. And when we create order and harmony, we actually produce energy. Well, not physically produce it, but we're able to use energy for other uses. So as those things are more ordered, they're easier to combine with one another as opposed to disorder, which would consume that energy, which requires more inputs. And that really ends up going into no useful end. So, again, the orchard, if we're having to do all those inputs because we can't run chickens through there, for example, to take care of some of our pests and weed needs, we're expending energy on other things that we could have otherwise used somewhere else. So that would be an opportunity cost. Another way to think about that is in the form of a question for the designer, the permaculture designer, and that is he would ask himself or her, how can I best use energy before it passes from my site or system? Okay, so how do I best use that? Do I best utilize it by using all the sprays and everything else? Or do I best utilize it by letting my chickens run through there so I get healthier eggs, I get more eggs, I have to feed them less because they're foraging more and taking care of pests and keeping weeds. You see what I'm saying? Okay, so that is what we desire to do. Now, what I want to do now is take you through some of Bill Mollison's principles that he applies towards permaculture. Now, Bill Mollison is really a guy named David Holmgren in the mid-70s really started developing these ideas about stable agricultural systems, and they were in southern Australia on the island state of Tasmania, and they put out, they coined the term permaculture. Okay, so they put out some publications, and eventually Permaculture, a Designer's Manual, has really become almost a standard for teaching a permaculture design course to thousands of people every year. And so they really kind of came up with these concepts and elements of design. So he's got his, let's see, there's five design principles, and that he is basically uses to help as a framework for thinking of permaculture design. And the first one is to work with nature rather than against it. Now, so we can assist rather than impede natural elements. So, like, for example, natural succession. If you think about a forest, if you clear cut a forest, let's just say, for example, you clear cut an area. I don't know how big. It doesn't matter. And did nothing. Eventually, that would grow back. It would be a succession into a forest. Okay, there's some exceptions to this, but that's what it would do in most cases. Now, it may take a couple hundred years, but that's what it would do. Now, in some places, that would take 5 or 10 years. Here in the Northwest, it's harder to try and make a pasture in some places because you're constantly fighting the seedlings coming back every year. Okay, so it depends on where you're at. This is why it drives me crazy when I hear people talk about, if you want to save the world, plant a tree. But I understand what they're saying. I understand what they mean. And it's a good thing to plant productive trees, and especially when you're talking about areas of the world where that can do a whole lot of good, that's important. But there's other areas where we use trees. There's nothing wrong with using trees, especially if what we're aiming for is a sustainable manner. So I cut down trees on my property, use them for fuel and lumber and everything else. And it's not a problem. In fact, I have to pull a whole lot more trees than I can use, to be quite honest. And I'm talking about thinning in this case. But I'm working with nature rather than against it. I don't want to constantly fight nature. Okay, so that natural succession, we can use that in some cases. So when what it does usually is some type of grasses or shrubs will... they'll give way eventually to the seedling trees, and that'll grow up, and then you're going to get trees. And that's kind of a natural succession in a forest region. Well, can we use that? Can we use areas where we have, say, a cold air that flows through, or a predominant wind from a certain direction? Can we use that? Can we plant things to help for the windbreak? And we're working with it and not against it. So an example would be, you know, do we take our orchard and spray for pests? And, you know, the reality is we end up destroying the pests and the predators that feed on them. And then usually the following year, it's even worse. And so we have to spray again and again. And you get on that chemical treadmill. So our first question should be, well, what other natural element can I bring in here to counteract these pests? It's not that in a permaculture system you won't get pests. Of course you will. You have to accept that. You have to be willing to accept that you may even lose some of your productive yields every year. And then the question you need to be asking is, okay, how do I attract predators of those pests? Okay, so because what you're trying to do is create that order and stability, that what you have is a balance that's out of whack. And that's why when we see the monocropping of today, what we're doing is we're setting the table. When you plant 1,000 acres of nothing but corn and you have nothing around it, there's no windbreaks, there's no trees, you just simply till the soil every time, you put in your corn, you'd use your chemical fertilizer and use your chemical herbicides and pesticides and fungicides, etc. You're setting the table, and you have to use those sprays, because if a pest did come in there, they're going to be like, hey, this is Christmas. I've got this entire thing that I love, and I've got nothing fighting me for it. So I'm going to call all my buddies, and we're going to take out this field. Okay, hence why we have to have pesticides, etc. Okay, so that would be working with nature instead of against it. His second principle is the problem is the solution. And what he means by this is that everything works kind of both ways. It's just a mindset shift, how you see it. Okay, so it's not just like you do in life when you see a problem. Most people see nothing but problems, whether you're at work or in your life in any way, you see nothing but problems. Well, the people that can shift that and go, okay, what are the opportunities here? Yeah, I've got this issue, but what are the opportunities? How can I use this situation to benefit, to better myself or the organization or whatever? Okay, it's a shift in mindset. The problem is the solution. The next principle would be to make the least change for the greatest possible effect. So I guess a couple of examples here. First, thinking about ponds. If you want to put in a pond on your property, which is a great thing. They're very beneficial for many reasons. So if you're thinking about putting a pond on your property, you want to find the right spot for a pond. So you're looking for the least change for the greatest possible effect. Okay, what's the least input I can put in and still get all the benefits from a pond? So this could mean area. So do you have any spots on your property that are naturally wet? They're, you know, almost like a small wetland area. Or if you have a draw on your property or a valley, depending on how you're looking at that terminology. Basically areas where lower that sits in between the fingers or ridges that where water runoff would go. Okay. In there is probably something in the areas where you're going to be able to put in a pond for the least effect. So, and particularly the actual dam site itself. So the dam wall where you're actually going to be holding the water back from, if that is the type of site you're looking at. So that's where you wouldn't necessarily put it in an area that's totally flat. You're going to have to, what you can do, and there may be some reasons to do that, but again, the principle there is trying to make the least change for the greatest possible effect. Here, another example would be looking at an area first to see, okay, what makes sense to grow here? Not, hey, I want to grow corn, so therefore I'm going to turn this property into a property that grows corn. Okay, you might have to do some serious work to be able to do that. Okay, say you have some sloped ground that is temperate climate, forested. So trees obviously do really well here. Well, maybe I can make some change in there. Maybe I can do some thinning and maybe run pigs or eat goats or something that would do well in that area, or productive trees. So again, I'm making the least change for the greatest possible effect. I can still get a great yield out of productive fruit and nut trees on a slope, just like a regular orchard on flatland. using this kind of a principle. Okay, so that's what is meant by that principle. The fourth is the yield of a system is theoretically unlimited. Okay, now that's a theoretical principle, and what it means is that there's probably always a way to stack more functions or add more to that area. And I'll give you an example. If you think of the person who lives in a high-rise apartment that's got a balcony garden, and this person is one of those, you know, gardeners, they'll use every inch of their space that they can. So they've got all this, you know, vertical growing area, and they're growing through in pots and all of that, and they're doing maybe even aquaponics or, you know, whatever. They're using every square inch of that space of that maybe that 10-foot by 5-foot balcony. Okay. Per square foot, that's going to be a whole lot more productive than the guy with, say, 40 acres. He may have some of his property in intensive-type gardening like that, but when you look at the whole, it's that 5 by 10 square foot area is more productive than if you compared it to another 5 by 10 spot on the guy with 40 acres. Okay, that's what is meant by that. So theoretically, the yield can continue to yield more. Okay, you can put in more. Now, we don't have the time, the people, or the resources, honestly, to do something like that intensive on our entire property. Not going to happen. But there's always, I can look at our property here and think way beyond what we can possibly do right now. Okay, way beyond it. So that's what is meant by that. So it's all based on the imagination of the designer. Okay, so that you can always do more. It's just that same principle. You can always improve it. All right, and then the last one is everything gardens. So yes, everything gardens, and it doesn't matter if we're talking about insects or birds or rabbits or deer or people. Okay, everything tries to set up a system in which they will thrive. And so what we need to consider here is kind of, you know, where do we or the rabbit or the deer belong in that system and how we manage that. So whether or not we should just manage their interaction, control it, tolerate it or not, okay? So, and if we're careful and we watch the interaction of plants and animals in those ecosystems, we may find allies and partners in our efforts to sustain what it is we're trying to achieve. Today, we talked about just really an overview of permaculture, what it is, what it's not, and just some of the principles involved. We really did not get into the nuts and bolts of design. I will do that in some later podcasts where we get into the very specifics, design principles, and then some very specific topics like developing a food forest, for example. But we'll save that for another time. Our scripture for today comes from Proverbs chapter 3, verse 3. Let not steadfast love and faithfulness forsake you. Bind them around your neck. Write them on the tablet of your heart. This concludes today's podcast. Thanks for listening. Please visit us on our website, thecourageouslifepodcast.com. We'd appreciate any comments or questions that you have. And also like us on Facebook, The Courageous Life Podcast. Semper Fidelis and Sole Deo Gloria. Thank you.